So we're going to do some fun things today, I think, but it'll take a little bit longer. I could stop and do the last 10 minutes on Friday, but I'm going to carry on. If you have to leave, do that. Then I'll do it. If you want to, if you have to leave, if there are people who do that, I'll finish it on Friday. But I'd like to get it all on one recording so you don't have to have two of them. Okay, so leave if you need to. Okay, so remember this last quarter of the course has a lot of physical concepts because we begin to add to the model. The whole semester has been about bonding, right? And we begin to add to the model of bonds the concept of energy, which requires measuring things. Here, incidentally, are some help sessions we'll have, so I'll be here on Friday, and then we'll have them Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, but the rooms haven't been assigned yet. I'll email you about that. Obviously, you're not expected to come to all of them, and I know you have other exams and so on, so that's why we give so many. So we were talking about bond strengths, whether there was such a thing as an energy associated with a bond, so that you could get the heat of atomization, the energy required to break a molecule apart into atoms, by adding up bonds. So the heat of atomization of CH4 experimentally is 397.5 kilocalories per mole. And you get that from the heats of combustion of methane and graphite and H2 and Chupka's experiment about the sublimation energy of carbon and so on. Okay, now, but is that actually if you divide that by 4, you get the average bond energy of 4 CH bonds, which is 99.4 kilocalories per mole. So the question is that really the bond energy? Is that how much energy you'd have to put in to break a bond? Well, these have been measured experimentally by spectroscopy and other means, for example, by Barney Ellison, who's a PhD from Yale, who's shown here, and who I think will come and give you a lecture in the spring. But anyhow, these guys have made very sophisticated experiments which have actually measured how much energy is required to break a CH bond in different situations, in different molecules. So if you take methane itself and break it, it's actually not 99.4, it's 104.99 plus or minus 0.03. That's pretty precise, right? Three parts in 10,000. But once you've got that, you have CH3, a free radical. If you break an H bond in that, it costs 110.4. Then in CH2, to break a bond is 101.3. But CH is actually rather easy to break that CH bond. It's 80.9 kilocalories per mole. If you add, but notice that no individual bond actually equals the average CH bond, because there are changes in hybridization and lots of other things as you go from one of these unusual species to another. So that shouldn't be a great surprise. But the sum of those is exactly the same as you get by a completely independent method, right? So these are really good experiments that have been done. But it shows that although there's such a thing as an average bond energy, it's not the energy of any particular bond. It's more or less that. I mean, within 10% or so, or a little worse than that. But these numbers are known to a few parts in 1,000. Okay? So you have this table that I showed you last time of average bond energy, and for carbon, as we've just shown, it's 99 kilocalories per mole. And we mentioned before that if you have a double or a triple bond, it's not the same as two or three single bonds. The second carbon-carbon bond, if the first one's worth 83 and the double bond is 146, the second one appears to be worth 63, the difference between those two. But actually, that's a little bit oversimplified because the pi bond is really weaker than 63 kilocalories per mole, because in going from a single to a double bond, the single bond got stronger because it's made of sp2 hybrids now instead of sp3, which it was when it was a single bond. Okay, so it's a little bit complicated if you want to think about it in detail. But if you wanted to say the third bond is worth 54 kilocalories per mole, so they get weaker and weaker. Okay, by contrast, if you look at the CO double bond, it's 176 or 179, depending on whether it's an aldehyde or a ketone you're talking about. The single bond was 86, so the second bond in CO is actually stronger than the first bond. Right? The first bond is 86. The second one is 90 to 93, depending on whether it's an aldehyde or ketone, stronger than the first. So this is what we emphasized before, that the carbonyl group is really very stable. Right? If you mean by stability, not how reactive it is, but how low in energy the molecules are that have that structural feature. But the question is then, just how good are these average bond energies if what you want to use them for is calculating the heats of atomization for other molecules, not the ones that they were derived on the basis of? Well, let's try it out. Remember before, last time we tried if we could get the heat of a compound by adding up just what elements are in there, a certain heat of combustion for carbon, a certain heat of combustion for hydrogen. So how about using bond energies instead? So we use constitution instead of just composition to try to get the energy. So here are these average bond energies, which I took from that previous table. And if we take ethene, it has four CH bond single bonds and one CC double bond. You add them together, you get 542. And the actual heat of atomization is 537.7. So that's not bad. It's off by 4 kilocalories per mole, or about less than 1%, 0.8%. Of course, that's not entirely fair, because those average bond energies depended in part on ethene. That was one of the molecules used in calculating the average. Okay. How about cyclohexane? 6 cc's and 12 ch's, 1686. The heat of atomization is 1680, off by 6 kilocalories per mole, 0.4%. Pretty good from adding bonds together. Cyclohexanol, remember we got in trouble with when we oxidized these, when we were just talking about how much C and H there was when they were partially oxidized. But now you see it's really pretty close, off by only 5 kilocalories per mole, 0.3%. And glucose, which has lots of oxygens in it, 7 CO bonds, right, is off by only 16 kilocalories per mole, or 0.7%. So this is a far cry from what we got when we were using just composition in the last lecture. It's 10 times better, much smaller errors, like in the case of glucose, 16 kilocalories per mole instead of 240. Much, much better. But is it good enough? Let's look again, although that these errors look very, very impressively low, let's remind ourselves of how accurate you have to be in order to be useful. Okay, what you want them for is to predict the equilibrium constants of molecules, or as you'll see at the end of the lecture, rate constants, right? So that depends on 10 to the minus 3/4 of delta H calculated. That would be the calculated equilibrium constant. That would be whatever the true equilibrium, the true energy difference is, plus some error. That's the calculated energy, right? So you see, the calculated equilibrium constant is the true equilibrium constant, which is the first part right here, right? This part right here is the true equilibrium constant. Then when you add exponents, you multiply, so it's times this part, right? 10 to the minus 3/4 of whatever the error was. So what errors can you tolerate? Well, 10 to the minus 3/4 of that error is going to be the fractional error, the multiplicative, the error factor in the equilibrium constant, right? So it's not the percent error, which we're very good on here, much less than 1%, right? But that's not what we care about. What we care about is the magnitude of the error. That's what enters in here, not what percent it is, okay? And we see if we want the error to be less than a factor of 10, then this has to be less than 4/3, right? So we need errors of less than 1.3 kilocalories per mole if we want to be within a factor of 10 in predicting an equilibrium constant. And here we have errors that are much bigger than that. So we're going to have to make corrections if we start on this basis. Can one sum the bond energies to get accurate, useful heats of atomization? Well, let's look, for example, at these two isomers of one another. They have the same elements in them, but we've moved a hydrogen from here up to there, right, to make the compound called an enol. It's an ene because it's got a double bond. It's an ol because it's a because it's an alcohol. Okay, so let's compare. We could add up all the bonds on both sides and see how they compare, right? But it's simpler just to add the bonds that change, right? Most of the bonds stay the same on the left and the right. It's only the red ones that change, okay? So we can add the ones that change. Okay, the C double bond O is in a ketone is 179, the CC is 83, CH is 99, the sum is 361 on the left. On the right, the ones that have changed add up this way, 343. So the difference between the two, the difference in energy, will then tell you what the equilibrium constant, the minus 3/4 times that, times 18 is the difference. So it'll be the equilibrium constant is predicted to be 10 to the minus 13.5. So very little enol, right? The equilibrium constant, 10 to the minus 13.5. Experimentally, the equilibrium constant is 10 to the minus 7th, right? It's off, which means that the actual energy difference was 9.3 instead of 18, right? So that's an enormous difference in how much of that enol there is. This would be negligible. This is actually a significant amount at equilibrium if it turns out, as it does, that this form can be particularly reactive. Okay, so why is it? Why do we have these differences between 18, the difference between 18 and 9.3? Well, so the enol is 9 kilocalories per mole too stable. That is, more stable than we would predict just by adding up these average bond energies. Can you see where we made a mistake? Let's look first at those two bonds, those red bonds. Can you see where we might have made an error involving those bonds? Notice we didn't use those bonds in the calculation. We said they'd be the same on the right and left, CH single bonds. Yeah? Aha, they have different hybridization. Right? SP squared over here. Right? So SP squared H's should be stronger, better overlap than SP3H. So they shouldn't actually cancel. So that'll make up some of the difference. But there's something else. Look at this. What about this? The fact that there's an unshared pair here and a double bond here. Yeah. Ah, homo-lumo interaction, right? There's intramolecular. This homo is going to mix with the pi star lumo here, which is going to give more stability than we would have thought if we didn't take that into account. So there's going to be, pardon me, that went by too quickly, there's going to be resonance stabilization as well. Okay, so if you want to do constitutional energy, that is, just see what nature and sequence of bonds and add them up, you're going to have to be doing a correction, right? There are going to be different effects you have to consider. Effects like resonance, this intramolecular homo-lumo mixing that we just saw. There are going to be effects like hybridization that we saw, where you have different kinds of CH or CC bonds, depending on what the hybridization of the carbon is. There's going to be another one, strain, which isn't taken into account when you're just talking about constitution. So we saw before that there was going to be special energy due to interactions like that. Okay, so what that means is these effects really are just a polite name for an error that you make when you use this simplistic scheme of just adding up bonds. You recognize situations in which there are going to be errors, so you call those effects and you try to make a correction for that. So you can do pretty well with bonds as energy if you take some of these other factors into account. I mean, in terms of percent errors, it does fabulously well. Unfortunately, you need to do better than that if you want to be useful, right? So you have to consider these corrections, these effects. Things like we talked about before in quantum mechanics, where you had correlation energy that you needed to add in as a correction. Okay, so energy determines what can happen. It determines equilibrium constant. You're never going to spontaneously go uphill in energy to something that's less stable, at least not very much of it. So we have the equilibrium constant, and we saw that, but it also determines how fast reactions happen. And reactions are going to be the name of the game next semester, right? So we're going to be very interested in how these structural considerations enter into determining the rates of processes. So the rate constant, the small k per second, is 10 to the 13th times an analogous exponential, very similar to this one, right? 10 to the minus 3/4 of delta E double dagger, and we'll talk about that. So what's so great about low energy? Here we've seen that equilibrium constants favor the things that are low energy. But why favor things at low energy? We've just seen that Congress is going to do things that will favor people that have a lot of money, not people that have a little money, right? What's so great about having small amounts of energy? Why not maximize your energy rather than minimize it? Okay, so that's what we're going to look at for a little bit here, about how energy relates to equilibrium constants. And it does it through statistics. It's really interesting, so I think it's important to take a little time to see this. In 1902, Yale published a series of books to celebrate its bicentennial, and this was what they said there. And the most of those books are pretty crummy, to be absolutely frank. But one of them is a real masterpiece of the human mind, and that's this one, Elementary Principles in Statistical Mechanics, developed with special reference to the rational foundation of thermodynamics by J. Willard Gibbs. So thermodynamics is founded on statistics, was his idea. Now, how does that happen? How does the exponent, the exponents you get in equilibrium expressions, how do they depend on statistics? They actually depend in three ways, the way equilibrium expressions work, depend in three ways on statistics, and we're going to look at those. The first one is the thing called the Boltzmann factor. That's E to the energy over KT. Okay, and then there's a factor called entropy, which is often said to be very mysterious, but also involves, as you'll see, an exponent. And finally, the law of mass action, where you have exponents on concentration. You have a concentration squared or maybe even a concentration cubed that enters in. So what we want to see is how those exponents are determined by statistics. Okay? Now, when you get to physical chemistry, you'll do this stuff in a more sophisticated way. But this, I think, will show you what's really involved. And first, we'll look on the Boltzmann factor. This is Boltzmann, 1844 to 1906. And this is his famous paper on the relationship between the second law of thermodynamics and probability calculation, statistics, right, regarding the laws of thermal equilibrium, 1877. So this is the same time that Van 't Hoff was doing arrangement of atoms in space. Okay, and his famous equation is S equals K log W. In fact, he was so enamored of that expression that if you look at his tombstone in the cemetery in Vienna, you see up at the top S equals K log W, right? And that's where the statistics comes in. So I want to show you how that works. What he did was to consider the implication of random distribution of energy among real atoms. Right? Real atoms is important because a lot of people didn't consider that atoms were real at that time. Remember, we talked about Ostwald, who it wasn't until 1909, 3 years after Boltzmann's death, that Ostwald finally capitulated and said, okay, I believe in atoms now. Right? And in fact, he debated Boltzmann, and Boltzmann was a sort of sensitive person. And in fact, in 1906, 3 years too early, he committed suicide because he was so depressed about the reception of this work of his. And in fact, he said toward the end, I'm conscious of being only an individual struggling weakly against the stream of time. But it still remains in my power to contribute in such a way that when the theory of gases, that is, molecules, is again revived, not too much will have to be rediscovered. What a poignant statement. But at any rate, this is the idea. Random distribution of energy, as if there were bits of energy that you could count. That's how you do the statistics. Among four containers. Now, what's a container? A container is something that can hold energy. Like a molecule can vibrate, right? So you can put energy into that vibration. A particular vibration, maybe a particular bond or a particular mode of vibration. Or it could put energy into its translational motion along the x-axis or the y-axis or the z-axis. So they're different containers, but let's just consider one type of container, like maybe a particular CH bond vibration or something like that. Okay, so we have a certain limited amount of energy that's available in an isolated system, a certain number of bits of energy. And the question is, what's the statistics of putting, if you have a bunch of these CH bonds, different molecules, what's the probability that there'll be a certain amount in one? Okay? So it's easy counted up if you have a limited number. Suppose you have 3 bits of energy and 4 containers you could put it in. Okay, now, what he called these different permutations of ways of putting energy into the bond, say, complexions. So we'll use his term. So how many complexions, how many permutations have a certain number of bits in the first container? Okay, so if the number is 3, there's obviously only one way of doing it. You put all 3 there. But if the number is 2, then how many ways are there of doing it so that you have 2 bits in the first container? Right, you can do that one, that one, that one. And there'll be 3 ways of doing it. This is assuming you can't tell the difference, that the energy bits are all the same. They're not a red one, a blue one, and a green one, and so on. Then you'd have to consider more possible patterns. But if they're indistinguishable, then there'll be 3 ways of doing it. Now, suppose you put only 1 in the first container. Now, how many ways are there doing it? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so there's 6 ways of doing that. Now, how many ways of putting none at all in the first container? Well, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Everybody with me? So 10 ways of doing that. So let's make a plot of how many, if they're distributed randomly, so all different ways, how many of them have a certain number in the first container? So here's a graph, right? There'll be 10 ways of having none in the first container, 6 ways of having 1, 3 ways of having 2, 1 way of having 3 in the first container, okay? Now, you can imagine doing this with greater numbers of bits and greater numbers of containers. For example, if you did it with 30 bits of energy and 20 places you could put it, then it would look like that. And what Boltzmann was able to show in 1877 mathematically is what the limit would be if you had a very large number of bits and a very large number of containers, and it looks like that. It's an exponential. So the probability of having a certain amount of energy decreases with that amount of energy, and it decreases exponentially, right? So Boltzmann showed that there was that the limit for many bits and many places to put it would be exponential, the probability of having a certain amount of energy in any one of them. Right? And you can see why that is, why it decreases. Because if all the complexions are equally likely, then shifting energy into any one degree of freedom, the one you're interested in, makes fewer permutations of all the rest, because there are not as many to permute. The more you put here, the fewer there are going to be ways of doing it out here. So it obviously gets smaller and smaller, and he showed it was exponential. Right? And in fact, the average energy, you can work out mathematically if you're skilled the way he was, the average amount of energy is 1/2 kT, where K is the constant that's become called Boltzmann's constant, not surprisingly. And it turns out to be 1.987, that's sort of easy to remember, calories, small calories, per mole, degree Kelvin. So temperature is average energy. Isn't that interesting? You just put that constant in there and temperature becomes average energy. Okay, but anyhow, it's exponential. So if you want to have a lot of energy in one place, like having a molecular structure that's higher in energy, and compare it with another one, the ratio between the two, the probability, if energy is distributed randomly, the probability ratio will be exponential in the difference in energy, which is what we've just been talking about, this 10 to the minus 3 fourths at room temperature, delta H. Difference in energy. So that's the Boltzmann factor. That's where that comes from. Just statistically, just counting up bits of energy. You know, at first, he thought this was just a mathematical trick. When you take bits of energy and you take the limit, then when the bits of energy become zero, so that it becomes a continuum. But then Planck found out that energy really did come in bits. It was quantized. That was a real surprise, right? But Boltzmann did it just as a mathematical trick. Okay, now entropy. So entropy is also statistics, and I want to show you that. In Feynman's Lectures on Physics, which is a marvelous three-volume set, he says it is the change from an ordered arrangement to a disordered arrangement, which is the source of irreversibility. Now, I think you've probably heard like that, right, that entropy is disorder. How many people have heard that entropy is disorder? Okay, that's what I want to show you today. So it's the change from an ordered to a disordered arrangement that makes it favorable to become disordered. Okay, now, so let's decide about order and disorder. Okay, which of these two pictures, so they have the same number of dots in both pictures. Which one is more ordered? How many people say the left? How many people say the right is more ordered? Okay, now I didn't surprise that there are few votes for the right. But now watch the right. So is the right ordered or not? Obviously it's ordered. It's ordered to show a dinosaur. Okay? And the same happened to shepherds out in their fields keeping their flocks by night. They looked up at the stars and saw bears and lions and dragons and stuff like that. There was order in the stars. Okay? Okay. So it's not as easy as you think. Now, I'm going to show you an experiment that I did. I could do it, but it's not so easy to see because it's small. It's just a couple pieces of glass. Here's a tube, nothing up my sleeve, right? And a glass rod, and I put it on here. And then what I'm going to show you a movie of is pouring Karo syrup into here. So it's on here if we're in business. Okay, you can click on this here to watch it yourself if you want to. So there's that device and my watch just to show, it didn't work out very well. To show, you can't read it very well, to show that I'm not doing tricks with the movie. Okay, so I'm pouring Karo syrup into that annulus, right, between the rod and the glass. Okay. This phenomenon we're going to illustrate is called Couette flow. Okay, now make a mark on the thing so you can see when I rotate the glass, the outer one. I'm going to hold the inner one fixed and rotate the outer one to stir it. And in order to see the stirring, I'm putting yellow dye in a strip of yellow dye into the Karo syrup. Okay, now we zoom in a little bit and I start my watch. Timex. Very sophisticated watch. Okay, and now I'm mixing it up by rotating that, right? So now after rotating it three times, it's all stirred up. Now I'm going to unstir it. And the watch kept running, right? Okay. That's called Couette flow, and you can read about it on the web page. Okay, this is how it works. That if you have the syrup is in this annulus between the center and the rim, right? And I put a little line of ink in there. And then I start rotating it. And of course, the outside rotates further than the inside, which isn't moving. So I rotate, rotate, rotate. And now I've got a strip that goes way around, right? And it looks like it's all mixed up. But if then I rotate back again, right? I can unwrap it. because the ink hasn't really diffused randomly, right? It's still ordered, but we couldn't perceive the order, right? Now here's a question. If the rotated state only seemed to be disordered, then we've got trouble, because if disorder is in our own eyes, how can it measure a fundamental property that's going to be fundamentally important in equilibrium and stuff like that? Right? So the problem is that a disordered arrangement, which was what Feynman talked about, is really an oxymoron. Arrangement means ordered. Disorder is different. How can you have a disordered arrangement? Right? The situation favored at equilibrium has particles that have diffused every which way. That didn't happen when I did this experiment, right? They didn't diffuse, right? They stayed in that same ribbon but got wrapped around, right? And the key word here is every, right? They didn't go every way. They went a specific way caused by the rotation, which I could then undo. Right? So a disordered arrangement is really what Feynman uses as a code word. He means a collection of random distributions whose individual structures are not obvious. Right? So there are lots of, if you let the things diffuse, there'll be, at any given time, there'll be one particular arrangement. Right? Each particle is in a certain place. But when he says disordered, he means not just that one particular arrangement like the dinosaur. He means all these different arrangements. Right? So if you count up all the ways that you think are ordered and all the ways you think are disordered, there's a big advantage for ones that are disordered. Right? There are a lot more ways of arranging where you don't see the order than when you do. Right? So it is favored at equilibrium to have a disordered arrangement because it includes so many individual distributions. Entropy is counting in disguise. Okay? For example, free energy is what's used. You've heard of free energy, I bet, G. Have you heard of that? That's both this heat we talked about, the bits of energy, the actual energy, and a factor that's put in to take entropy into account. So entropy enters into free energy. Now, it's very common to see a value of entropy, which turns out to be 1.377 entropy units, which looks like a funny number to have crop up all the time. But I want to show you where it comes from. So that happens to be R times the log of 2. And it's a very common difference in entropy between things. For example, it's the difference in entropy between gauche and anti-butane. Okay? Now, why? So the equilibrium constant, if you take entropy into account and use free energy instead of just H, the actual energy, then you have this expression, but you can expand it, de-simplify it, by putting in separately the delta H part, the bits of energy, and this entropy part, which you put in with T delta S. So it looks like temperature has something to do with the contribution of entropy to an equilibrium constant, right? But really, that's not true. Temperature has to do with H, not with S, because look, if you separate these two, it looks like that. But if you cancel out the T's here, you see that the part that has to do with entropy doesn't have T in it. It's this part that has T in it. Okay? So E to the delta S over R, what is that when we have this 1.377 entropy units as the delta S? Okay, so that's R log 2 divided by R. So we can simplify that. It's E to the log 2. Does anybody know what that is? It's a factor of 2 that enters fairly often. Why is there a factor of 2 in comparing gauche with anti-butane? Anybody see this? Because there are two gauche butanes. So what nonsense to talk about 1.377 entropy units when what you really mean is that there are two of these and one of those. It's counting. Now, usually it's more sophisticated counting than that because you're interested in how many quantum states there are in one product compared to another. So the conclusion is that that just means a factor of 2, that K depends on T because of delta H, not because of delta S, and that free energy and entropy sometimes obscures what is fundamentally really simple. Okay, so if we summarize this, the equilibrium constant, you have the Boltzmann factor, which we saw, that comes from counting random arrangements of a fixed number of energy bits, right? Now, that's interesting, that randomness, because, you know, we looked at the beginning this, and Hamlet has a thing, there's a divinity that shapes our ends. You know, there's something that's controlling how everything is proceeding here on Earth. But the people who advocated divine intervention were really offended by Darwin in the 19th century. But that's not who they should have been offended by. They should have been offended by Boltzmann, because he's the one that said everything is just random, right? Darwin could have been that the creator is entering into evolution somehow. But this is completely random, Boltzmann. But nobody understood Boltzmann. So these people didn't get down on Boltzmann's case. Okay, so anyhow, you have then also the end. So that actually, this part, the Boltzmann part, really is entropy, sort of, you know, random distribution enters into that. Okay, but then there's explicitly randomness in the entropy factor. And notice that although it's often written KT here and RT here, those are actually exactly the same thing, because K is per individual molecule and R is per mole. So this is just this multiplied by Avogadro's number. They're R and K are the same thing. It just depends on whether you're talking about individual molecules or moles of molecules. Okay, and this comes, remember, this comes from counting how many, 2 versus 1 for gauche butane versus anti-butane. This W is how many counts you get of the arrangements, right? And that's what Boltzmann put on his tombstone, S equals K log, how many of them there are. Okay, so look at cyclohexane, for example. So this is here's chair cyclohexane, which you remember you held and it's very stiff, hard to deform, right? So you go way up here, but then when you get to the twist boat form, you remember you could do this and it easily changes from one to the next. So there's small barriers up here. It takes 10-11 kilocalories to get out of the chair, but it only takes 1.5 kilocalories to get out of one twist boat to another. So if you had this situation, notice there are many structures here which count as twist boat, but only 2 that count as chair. So there's a big statistical advantage for twist boat, right? By the same token, if you do quantum mechanics, where it's really stiff, you have quantum states that are very widely spaced, not very many quantum states, where you have a lot here. So no matter which you choose, whether you choose a classical picture of how many chairs and how many boats, or whether you choose a quantum view of how many quantum states there are for chair and how many quantum states there are for the twist boat, either way, you get an entropy factor, more boats than chairs, of about a factor of 7. Right? So if you consider only the energy, the Boltzmann factor with enthalpy, that's the energy part, there's a bias of 10 to the minus 3/4 times 5.5. That's the energy from here to here, 5.5, right? A factor of 14,000 in favor, but that would be it, except that this factor of 7 cuts that down from 14,000 to only 2,000, right? Because floppy molecules have many more states than rigid molecules do. So although we discussed entropy theoretically in statistical terms, physical chemists can also measure it experimentally. And we talked about that, in fact, with the rotation of ethane and entropy, although it wasn't very understandable, I suspect, at the time we talked about it. But the entropy of a perfectly ordered crystalline material at 0 Kelvin is 0. There's only one way to have that crystal, right? So it's log of 1. 0, right? But as you warm it, it begins to get different arrangements, and all as the material is warmed, it gains entropy in increments. So every degree you go up, you get a given increment in entropy, which is how much heat you put in divided by temperature. And that's what people measured calorimetrically, these guys at Berkeley, right? So floppy molecules, which have closely spaced quantum levels, absorb more energy. We saw that in the case of ethane. And they absorb it at lower temperature. So you get more entropy in these floppy things, but you also count more of them if they're floppy. There are more arrangements which count, right? So either way of doing it, experimentally or theoretically, statistically, you get the same thing. Okay, so that's the entropy. And now we have, so that counts, that's from random arrangement of fixed number of energy bits, and this is counting W, the number of quantum states, which are grouped together under a certain name, like twist boat cyclohexane. Okay? And that, and then those, for elegance or convenience or confusion, really, these two factors are linked together when you talk about G. Okay. Now, the third statistic way statistics come in is the law of mass action. And this is the simplest of all. It comes from counting how many molecules there are in a unit volume. So the law of mass action was discovered late in the 1700s because people began to try to assemble a hierarchy of affinities, that some atoms had more affinity for other atoms than others did. Right? So if you have a competition, if you react things, the ones with the higher affinity will get together. That was the idea. But then it was found that you could have things go the other way if you fiddled with the concentrations. You could go against the affinities. So in the early 1800s, it was shown that the concentration can shift the reaction direction away from what affinities would predict. And by the mid-1800s, the equilibrium constant was interpreted as a balance between rates going one way and rates going the other. And if you adjust the concentrations, you can make things go the wrong way toward lower affinities. Right? Now, these laws, equilibrium or rate laws, were expressed for an expression like the one at the top. You have an equilibrium constant like this. And notice that you have a square there. So the dimer of A equals some constant times the square, the concentration, times the square of the concentration of A. Now, where does that exponent come from? Why do you have this exponent? Remember, we already looked at H in the exponent. We looked at S in the exponent and saw that that was absolutely bogus. It was just a coded way of saying a factor of two, right? But this, where does this exponent come from? Okay, so suppose you take randomly distributed particles, 50 particles in here, and you look at them and see how many overlap one another, so that we'll consider them dimers. Okay, and there's just one. And now we'll put 50 more in, have 100 arranged at random. And now you see there are 9 dimers. And if you go to 150, there are 19 dimers. And if you go to 200, there are 35 dimers. Right? And if you go to 250, there are 59 dimers. So if we plot this, how many dimers there are as a function of how many particles there are in our certain volume, we see that it's parabolic, right? That it goes with the square. Why does it go with the square? Increasing concentration increases both how many units there are in there that could be dimers and what fraction of them have neighbors that are nearby, near enough to call dimers. So there are two different ways in which increasing the concentration increases the dimers. First, by just increasing the number altogether, and then by increasing the fraction of them that have a near neighbor. Right? So it comes in twice. And if it were three, if there were three that had to get together, it would be the cube. So that's where those exponents come in. So equilibrium statistics and exponents. We have the particle distribution, which is the law of mass action, which is that one. We have energy distribution, the Boltzmann factor, which is that one. And we have counting quantum states, which gives us delta S, but really it's only a question of counting. So free energy determines what can happen at equilibrium. Right? There's energy and entropy folded into G. Right? But how quickly will it happen? That's kinetics. In fact, this stuff up here that they were talking about in physical chemistry before we came in was about kinetics. And we'll talk more about this next semester. But I want to just get your minds arranged for this by visualizing reactions. So we're going to talk about classical trajectories and the potential energy surface. So this is a neat picture made by Eric Heller, a theoretician at Harvard, and sold as artwork. He made a lot of these. He's good at computer graphics, and he's sold a lot of things and has had shows and so on. And this is one. And what it is, I added these annotations here. His was just the curly things. What this is the trajectory for non-reactive collision of 13 atoms in 6 molecules and 40 dimensions, right? 13 atoms, XYZ, that's 39, plus a final 40th dimension, which is time. Can you see how time enters into this? This is a picture of 13 atoms, but there are a lot more dots than 13. Why? How is time being shown? Yeah, Amy, you got any? Right, it's like a stroboscopic picture. You know, you've seen those of a runner or a horse or something where Edward Muybridge did this, 100 years ago, right? So what it is superposition of a lot of pictures. And so let's look just at a part of it here. And here we see dots that are really close together, right? And here those same things, after they've been involved in a collision, are coming out. And now they're further apart. Why? Yeah. This is at equal times, pictures are taken. Yeah. Can't hear. Yeah, they're farther apart if they're moving faster, right? Between successive clicks of your camera. Okay, so this diatomic molecule, a blue atom and an orange atom, came in, they were involved in a collision, and as a result of the collision, they're now moving faster. But they're still the same molecule. There were no reaction. Okay? Now, why is this twisted, these two strands? Why don't they just go like this? Why is it twisted? Because the molecule, Liang says, is rotating as it's going in. Right? And as it's going out, these strands get further apart and closer together, which wasn't happening on the way in. Why is that? Why do they have this funny shape going out when they were smoother coming in? Christina? It's got more energy. So what's happening?
It's got more energy.
Yeah. Well, it's moving faster. That's because we know that because the dots are further apart. But why do the lines get closer and further from one another there irregularly, or it's actually regular, but where they look so smooth going in? They're vibrating as well as rotating, right? So you get that funny behavior. Okay, so it's going slower here and faster here. Here it's rotating slowly. Here it's rotating faster. And it's also vibrating. Okay, notice the funny shape of this one. The purple one goes almost straight. But the yellow one does a complicated dance around the purple one. Why? Because the purple one is a really heavy atom. And the yellow one is a light atom. Isn't that cute? So the yellow one does all the relative motion. But this is way too complicated for our purposes, right? There wasn't even a reaction here, and it's already very complicated. If you tried to do all the different ways these things could collide, it would be just hopeless, right? So, another way of doing it, which also will turn out incidentally to be a little bit complicated, is to use what's called the potential energy surface for stretching. And here we'll do it just for a diatomic molecule, AB. So here's the AB distance, and here's the potential energy, and you've seen curves like that. So we could imagine building a mechanical thing like that and putting a ball on it, and it would roll back and forth, right? So AB stretches and shrinks, stretches and shrinks, and as it does so, the potential energy responds. And it's moving fastest down here when it has the lowest potential energy, and so on, because it has the highest kinetic energy. So that's quite simple. But now suppose we had three atoms. Now, if you have three atoms, you have too many coordinates to plot. Okay? But if there are three atoms that are all on the same line, right, then it's much easier. All you need is a distance from the center one to this one, and the center one to this one, and then you know, as long as they're on a line, where they are. So you can plot all the arrangements, all the linear arrangements, with just two dimensions, the distance from B, the center one, to A, and the distance from B to C on the other side. Okay, so every point on here corresponds to a given arrangement of those three particles, right? And we've coded the third dimension, which is energy coming out toward you. So this is a topographic map of that. Okay, so it has to be linear so that you can use just two dimensions to specify the structure. So there's a valley there. What is that valley? It has a small distance of BC. B is bonded to C. But an arbitrary distance as the valley goes out of A to B. So you have an A atom plus a BC molecule in this valley. In this valley, you have the... up here, you have a plateau. What's that? That plateau has all the atoms separate from one another. Nothing's bonded. Okay? And over there, of course, you have... Over here, you have A, B plus C. And here's a cliff. What's the cliff on this side of the valley? Why does the energy go up so much when you go to that cliff? You're changing this, right? B is getting too close to C. It's shorter than the bond distance. Okay, so we see all those things. There's a ridge. That ridge separates the two valleys, right? So on one side you have the BC molecule plus A, the other side you have the AB molecule plus C. So getting across that ridge is reacting, right? Putting the B molecule, make it go from being attached to C to being attached to A. So a reaction is getting across that ridge, right? And there is a very special place, because that's the lowest point on the ridge. If you were hiking and tired and you needed to get from this valley to this one, that's where you'd head. Okay? And that's called the transition state or the transition structure. And it's like a potato chip, right? Because in one dimension it's curved this way, that's going up the ridge. But it's a minimum along that, but it's a maximum to get from one valley to the other. Okay. So now let's make a slice through this thing up at the top and fold it back so we can see what it looks like. Right? It looks like that. That's the same picture we saw before for vibration of the AB molecule with C very far away. And we could slice there and see the same thing for B and C. Stretching. So that's vibration of BC with A as a spectator far away. Now we could trace a curve on that. And what does that curve show? What happened? Here we had BC and A far away. What's happening as we go in this direction? As we go up to the left? What's happening to BC as we go up this way? Aisha? B and C are stretching. What about A as you're going up here? So A is coming in and colliding with a stretching BC molecule, right? And that happens more and more, and then what happens? It bounces off. A bounces off, and you're left with BC molecule a little bit stretched here. But you'll go back out the valley vibrating like that. So A collided with BC and made it vibrate more. Okay? Or we could have this. A is approaching a non-vibrating BC, but then it gets across the ridge here, right? And now what's happening here? What do we have here? What does vertical motion mean? It means C is flying away from B. What does the fact that it's going back and forth mean? That AB is vibrating. So A approaches a non-vibrating BC molecule, and then C flies away from a vibrating AB molecule after the reaction, which happened here when you went by across that ridge. Okay? Now, this is a classical trajectory. It's not quantum mechanical, because it wasn't vibrating here. we know that there's the lowest amount of vibrational energy you have. You can't really do this. Now, in fact, in 1935, Eyring, who was at Princeton then, calculated such a surface for H3, H2 plus H, right? And he had this, the crazy angle of the axis, not right angle, is such that things will be accurate for H3. If you roll a marble on that surface, it would behave properly. Map what would happen classically, mechanically, with those different energies. There's one thing he calculated was a depression here at the transition state, which people referred to as Lake Eyring, and it turns out to be absolutely unrealistic, right? It's not true. It's a potato chip, not a lake there. Okay, so forget Lake Eyring, but that's what he had. But now here's a H plus HBR. This was calculated in 1960, I think. Here it says 1969. And in fact, it was actually constructed. So can you see this thing here? This is that. In fact, that's Xeroxed from the bottom of this thing, right? So you can take a marble and roll it here like this. So what's happening when the marble rolls like this? Right? So each of these is a trajectory. Wow, we almost made it to react. There we did it. Now that one rolled across the X, right? Rolled across the transition state. But much more often you just get close to it. You don't go exactly over the X. Right? So, you could do this, and people actually do this, theoreticians. They run it a zillion times and look at all the different phases of amounts of vibration and phases of vibration at which something coming in a certain way hits it. All this is collinear, right, in order to be two geometric dimensions. So, people actually do this kind of thing. Now, we started in the first lecture with my son, John McBride, and this is him with his grandfather in 1973, and he and his sister have just been taken by their grandfather to catch a fish, and the fish John caught was wider than the New York Times, and he started crying. And his grandfather said, "What's wrong?" And John said, "I wanted to catch a little one." Right? That's the problem with this. It's way too big. There's way too much information we can't possibly handle to do all these different ways of colliding. We need something simpler. Right? So studying lots of random trajectories provides way too much detail. So what we want to do is summarize it statistically using collective values of enthalpy and entropy. So this is what we do, right? We slice this surface just along an arbitrary path, say the steepest descent path, the way the marble would roll down if you put it on the X and let it go. Actually, it's not the way the marble would go, but that kind of thing. And then we'll take that cross-section and flatten it, tip it up, and we'll get a thing that looks like this. Here's AB plus C, here they're all together at the transition state, and here are the products. Okay? So this is called a reaction coordinate diagram. We go do a reaction as we go across here, right? But this is not a realistic trajectory. Those are realistic trajectories, but there are way too many of them. Okay? So what we do is consider it not as a trajectory, but as a set of just three species: starting materials, transition state, products. And we forget the geometric detail, but we assign each of these things a certain free energy. So there's a free energy for starting material, a free energy for the transition state, and a free energy to the products. Now the difference between these two is going to determine the equilibrium constant. But the difference between these is going to determine the rate. Okay? So that was the idea of this. So free energy determines what can happen, equilibrium, and how rapidly it can happen. Right? This way. So that's the amount at the this is an equilibrium, like an equilibrium constant. And that double dagger means we're talking about the difference between transition state and starting material. So this part says how much stuff is at the transition state. And the other part says how rapidly it's moving. So if you know how much is there and how fast it's moving, then you know how much product you're getting in a given time. So that 10 to the 13th is the estimate of a universal constant, which isn't really true, but is pretty close, for how fast things move. Okay? So since the transition state is not truly in equilibrium with starting materials, and the velocity is not universal, this theory, Eyring's theory, transition state theory, is only approximate. But that's the way we summarize all these things. Now, this is, we're now in the end of the semester here. So in 1953, there was this important book, which is called Structure and Mechanism in Organic Chemistry. And here in 1959 is the book I used when I took advanced organic chemistry, which is called Mechanism and Structure in Organic Chemistry. And here's a book that I'm sure one of you has. Who has this book? Okay, good. And notice it says Structure and Function, right? And here's an advanced organic chemistry, which is Structure and Mechanism, right? And part B is Reactions and Synthesis. That's a two-volume advanced organic chemistry. But all these things have to do with structure and mechanism, right? Organic chemistry didn't used to be like that. It was just reactions that you memorized, right? But now structure is a big part of it. And the reason that in this course we've done so much with structure in the fall is because my training is in physical organic chemistry, right? In understanding how reaction, and that's because I was taught advanced organic chemistry and worked as a graduate student with Paul Bartlett, who was at Harvard and a very great person, right? Now, in 1939, this book came out, The Nature of the Chemical Bond, and it's probably the most influential book that was written in the 20th century, The Nature of the Chemical Bond. And that's what we've been talking about. And I forgot to plug in here so that you could hear Dunnett's actually saying this, but if you do it on your own laptop and turn the sound up, you can hear it. He said, at the time when I was reading that book, I was wondering whether chemistry was really as interesting as I had hoped it was going to be. And I think I was almost ready to give it up and do something else. I didn't care very much for this chemistry, which was full of facts and recipes and very little thought, very little intellectual structure. And Pauling's book gave me a glimpse of what the future of chemistry was going to be, and particularly perhaps my future. And in fact, after he got his PhD, he went to postdoc with Pauling at Caltech. And we've seen him appear in this course a number of times already. So the chemical bond and structure is what we've been talking about this fall, and in the spring we'll talk about mechanisms of reactions and many different kinds of reactions and how you synthesize things. But remember what we've gone through. We talked, is there an atomic force law, was right at the beginning, about feeling and seeing molecules and bonds, are they real, about how to understand bonding and reactivity through Schrödinger's equation. And then in the second half of the course of the semester, we worked about how chemists learn to treasure composition and constitution, configuration, conformation, and finally, in this last little bit, energy as things that control how things work. So here are some big questions that it would be good to think over before the final. How does science know things? Right? Compared to what? Right? Were chemical bonds discovered or were they invented? Did chemical bonds exist before there were chemists? Would we even have chemical bonds if we didn't have the history that we've gone through? Suppose that in some different solar system, it turned out that Schrödinger had been transported there and had given the Schrödinger equation before Lavoisier and all these people, so that people could just use computer programs, they have computers in this solar system, with fancy programs in it, and could calculate the energy of all different arrangements of atoms, and therefore could construct surfaces like that and figure out the rates of reaction. Would there be a need for bonds? Would anybody ever have talked about them? Okay, I think that's it. So we'll see you for review on Friday. Thanks for staying an extra whatever number of minutes.